Our next speaker is Christopher Contag from Stanford University. He's in the Department of Pediatrics, Radiology, Microbiology, and Immunology. You have it right there for you. So. And he's a pioneer in biophotonics and tracking stem cells with photons. So he's going to tell us about that.
So we got into the field of imaging from the biology side with the idea that we should be able to make our animal models transparent to scientific investigation. We wanted to put the imaging in the hands of the biologists so that they could study their biological questions in the context of a living animal. So I like this movie for a couple of reasons, because it demonstrates all the reasons that you'd like to image in animal models. And I like it for another reason, in that all these images were taken by a single undergraduate who lived in the lab, because he took images every 2 hours for 2 days, and then every 4 hours for another 4 days. So he essentially lived in the lab with his alarm set for every 2 hours. And shortly thereafter, he left the lab. I don't really know why. Seems to me that would be an interesting way to do science, just live in the lab. But he went to work with orphans in Nicaragua. I think it was a friendlier work environment. And now he's a practicing physician. So that comments a little bit on how old this movie is. And the fact that you've seen images like this with luciferase reporters throughout the meeting indicates that we were successful in getting the imaging tools into the hands of the biologists. So we started imaging organ transplants and tissue transplants very early on after we described this imaging tool. And we started with whole bone marrow, with the idea that we could watch the engraftment and proliferation of these cells. And I like this image because it's really a spectacular demonstration of this tool. However, what I don't like about it is it doesn't tell me anything about what happens here between the first day and the fourth day, even though the images are striking, because we had to transplanted 5 million whole bone marrow cells. We don't know much about the biology, so we went to working with more highly refined populations of cells. We worked with Amy Wagers and Irv Weissman on hematopoietic stem cells, and we've actually transplanted each of these populations and asked where they go and what they do when they get there. And I'd like to show a demonstration. I'd like to talk about today the long-term HSCs and some of the ways we've been using imaging to set up competition studies to begin to understand some of the biology of the stem cell. So after transplanting 5 million whole bone marrow cells, we went to smaller and smaller numbers of hematopoietic stem cells. In this study, it was 10, 50, and 250 cells. And we could count the sites of engraftment, and we could count those foci, kind of an in vivo colony-forming unit assay. We could ask where they were. We could calculate the compartment size, because when you inject the cells, they go to the bone marrow of the spleen, and it turns out that the larger the compartment, the more cells went there. So it's simply a matter of the size of the compartment. And if you transplant 10 hematopoietic stem cells, you tend to get 20% engraftment efficiency, so 2 cells out of 10 engraft. And we were looking at these animals over time, and we said, well, we don't really know what happened to this stem cell. We think that it probably participated in hematopoiesis, and here's another one that engrafted, but then either may have moved and moved again, or it just simply died out, and this daughter cells from this focus were the ones moving into other compartments in the body. So we realized that even though small numbers of cells are informative, because we can count engraftment efficiency and things like that, we had to go to even smaller numbers of cells. And so we went to single hematopoietic stem cells and transferred single cells. They're labeled with both luciferase and GFP, so you can pull the green cell out of the well and inject a single cell. And this is the experiment that got us thinking about setting up in vivo competition assays, because if you transfer individual stem cells, you see a couple of different results. Again, you get a 20% engraftment efficiency. So to study 20 animals, you set up 100. And in this case, you see this group of cells participated in hematopoiesis in a big way. Here's an animal that's treated identically. They look very similar at day 12. But this one didn't participate in hematopoiesis. And we were looking at this and we were thinking, well, maybe there's heterogeneity in this population. Maybe it wasn't quite as pure as we thought. But we also reasoned that in order to protect these animals, we had to transplant stem cell depleted bone marrow. And if we missed one dark stem cell in this population, or in these irradiated animals, if we missed one stem cell, that would outcompete this one, and we wouldn't see this pattern. In this case, there are very few, if any, dark hematopoietic stem cells, and here there must be a couple that are outcompeting this one. So we thought we should then be able to set up competition assays and add two different types of stem cells, either gain of function or knockouts, and ask which stem cell wins, and in an assay that would look like this. So we wanted to select genes that would play a role in the very early events, and we were thinking about the process that these cells go after you take them from the donor, take them from a labeled donor mouse, purify the HSCs through several hours of flow cytometry, inject them back into an irradiated host. The cells go into the blood vessel, then they engraft in the marrow, expand, differentiate, and then circulate. And we reasoned that this was probably very stressful for the hematopoietic stem cells, so we wanted to look at some of the stress genes that might control stem cells' choice to differentiate or self-renew. We've been working on an enzyme called heme oxygenase 1 for some time. It's described in the literature as the quintessential stress response element because it responds to infection, metalloporphyrins, hemolysis, heavy metal exposure, hypoxia, ischemia, and it produces then toxic molecules. It produces iron, carbon monoxide, and biliverdin, which all play a role in a variety of different processes. It seemed to be a key enzyme in a variety of different cellular responses. Also, it's a very old enzyme. You find it in some bacteria and also in plants. We also liked it because it was a therapeutic target for neonatal jaundice, and a number of molecules have been developed, small molecules have been developed that would block HO activity. Enzyme catalyzes the rate-limiting step in the conversion of heme to bilirubin and produces, as I mentioned, carbon monoxide, iron, and biliverdin, which then is converted to bilirubin. And as I said, the quintessential stress response element. We also liked it because it had this yin-yang of, we started studying it simply because we're interested in the gene regulation. That's kind of a yin-yang effect on cells. You express a little bit of HO1, you protect the cell from apoptosis. You overexpress HO1, and it dies of apoptosis. So it seemed to have a very interesting balance that was a particular interest for us to study, as well as its role in development, developmental regulation. So we looked at HO1 knockout animals and compared the stem cells from those animals after transplantation into an irradiated wild type, and asked how do the wild type and the heterozygous and homozygous cells compare in a transplantation model. So here we transferred 250 hematopoietic stem cells. And at initial glance, you'd say they look very similar. It might be that the heterozygous knockouts have slightly more proliferation than do the wild types, and perhaps the homozygous knockout didn't perform quite as well. But what was really striking is if we look at subsequent days, is that even though there might have been a slightly more proliferation at the early stage, the cells burned out over time, and you can track that over this 40-day time course. So it appeared as if the even a heterozygous knockout had a dramatic effect on these cells. And if you try to rescue animals with the knockout cells, they don't perform nearly as well as the wild type at very low numbers. However, and this is 2 × 10^5 whole bone marrow. However, if you increase the number of cells from the knockout donor that you give to the irradiated wild type, you can actually achieve a complete reconstitution from a large number of cells. So it seemed a bit paradoxical to us that you'd have this hyperproliferation, but an inability to rescue unless you provide enough cells. And so we wanted to look at that a little bit further. And so we transplanted, again, whole bone marrow. We saw, again, this hyperproliferation from the knockout animals. And you can appreciate that just in the size and the appearance of the spleen. More bioluminescent cells and larger spleens. And total number of splenocytes was also quite high. And it seems we reasoned that this might be due to the carbon monoxide, but carbon monoxide is diffusible factor, and we're putting these cells, these knockout cells, into wild-type animals where there should be plenty of hemoxygenase and carbon monoxide available. So here's where we did that competition experiment. We set up the two groups of animals, either with luciferase-labeled wild-type cells and then unlabeled knockout, or the converse. And you see what we'd seen in the previous experiments, that if you knock out one of the alleles, that you have hyperproliferative response of the HSCs. And that these cells would always win out over the wild type in a single transplantation. So it seemed, again, as a bit of a paradox that the cells with reduced HO1 are unable to rescue irradiated recipients from failure, but these recipients fail to survive despite exhibiting this accelerated hematopoiesis with greater numbers of blood cells. And so we reasoned that to study this, we'd need to look in a serial transplant model where we would take the either wild-type donors or the heterozygous knockouts, transplant the cells, and of course monitor their engraftment and proliferation over time using luciferase imaging, and serially transplant 1/5 of the bone marrow sequentially over this 12-week period. And so what you see in the first pass is exactly what I've shown you before, this hyperproliferation of the knockout cells. But as you serially transplant these cells, they lose that hyperproliferative ability, and the scales are changing as you go. Just you can see these differences here, and the ratios are plotted underneath. But after serial transplantation, the HO knockout cells burn out. They lose the ability to rescue these animals, and the wild-type cells outperform these cells. So we started to look at some of the possible targets for the byproducts of the hemioxygenase reaction, probably the carbon monoxide. And if you look at HSCs and the MPPs and the restricted progenitors, and you look at P38 MAP kinase, HSCs aren't dramatically different whether they come from the knockout or the wild type. MPPs have reduced P38, as do the restricted progenitors. In a similar type of analysis looking at P21, the controls show that if you knock out one allele, you have reduced HO1, but no effect on the isozyme HO2. But in the progenitor cells, the P21 is reduced. In contrast, P21 in the HSCs is increased. And so the rationale was that through this difference in P21 levels, the system was trying to retain a balance where the cells that had left the hematopoietic the stem cell compartment would proliferate, but the stem cells would be preserved. So we think of it kind of in this way. If you think of the of the cell cycle, is that P21 regulates the cell cycle, and HO1 through carbon monoxide affects P21, and releasing cells out of the HSC pool and into the circulation where they then go into cell cycle. And once they get to this point and exit the first cell division, the P21 drops and the P21 in the HSCs is retained. So the idea is that the cells would be trying to preserve the stem cell pool while allowing these cells to proliferate. And we can phenocopy this with some of the small molecule inhibitors, where if we treat with tin mesoporphyrin during the time of transplant, that we can get this hyperproliferative effect. And that increases the survival of the animals. And so you have with a transient regulation, a downregulation of hemoxygenase, we can recapitulate what happens with the knockout animals. So we've been really happy with this ability to look at the macroscopic view of stem cell biology in intact animals, but there's some studies we'd like to do where we'd like to look at the cells with cellular resolution. And so we reasoned that to do that in the way we'd like to really study stem cell biology in the living animal, we would take a confocal microscope design and try to miniaturize it such that we could implant this in the animal and watch the cells in the bone marrow. And I brought one of these little microscopes with me. You don't usually get to carry your microscopes to seminars. But the idea would be that you can implant this in the mouse and have the little tether coming out and plug the animal in every time you want to take an image of the activity of the stem cells. So to do that, we had to kind of change the architecture of a confocal microscope. Rather than illuminate on one path and collect on the same path, we have one illumination path and one collection path, represented here by the blue and the red, where the light comes down one path, hits a scan mirror that I'll show you in just a moment, and then hits a parabolic mirror to, as acting as the lens, a second parabolic mirror, second scan mirror into the tissue, and the fluorescence is then collected on a mirror image. We don't get quite the resolution that you'd get with a standard confocal. Standard confocal would get you down below a micron. Here we're around a couple of microns to 4 microns in the Z, depending on wavelength. And this design enables the use of very simple optics. This catadioptric lens is both transmissive and reflective and can be simplified, and also provides a very long working distance so we can scan this beam with the two scan mirrors. If you look at the forward-looking device and look at how this scans, we have a scan mirror in the back, a MIMS mirror that's scanning in the Z. We call this our sewing machine scans. It's kind of poking through the tissue optically, looking for interesting features, either interesting pathology or cells of interest. If we find something of interest, we could use the other mirror, which is an XY scan mirror. And this mirror would scan a plane, so you're optically sectioning the tissue, much like a pathologist would physically section it. Alternatively, if you run both mirrors simultaneously, you can collect a cubic volume of tissue, and you can ask how cells interact with at a tissue depth of several hundred microns, collecting a cubic volume of data. We initially designed these microscopes so that we could we could do in vivo pathology in patients and do diagnosis on site rather than biopsy and send to the pathology lab, try to do it right inside the patient. And here's some examples of some of the targets we've been looking at. This is a condition called Barrett's esophagus. Almost all of us over the age of 50 have an esophagus that looks like this. This is where the esophagus feeds into the stomach. And with age, these muscles degenerate and relax and allows acid reflux, causing the tissue to reorganize from this beautiful leopard print to one that looks more like intestinal glandular structures. And what we're imaging here with this dual-axis microscope is this junction region right here. We got into this field because I was talking to an endoscopist, and I said, well, when you see an esophagus like this, what do you do? And he says, well, we'll go in and do quadrant biopsies. And what that means is they'll look at this tissue, and they'll take a sample here. We'll take a sample up here. Take a sample here, and then they'll continue going down at a centimeter at a time, continually sampling the tissue. And I said, well, this is fantastic. Then if you find some cancer in one of these samples, you just go back to that site and you look more thoroughly to see if this predisposing condition to cancer led to a malignancy at this point. And he said, unfortunately, we can't do that because we only get reimbursed for 2 pathology samples. And so we take all 50 of these, we put 25 into each of 2 tubes and send them to PATH, with no idea where they came from, and they look at a percent or two of the total tissue we send them and try to make a diagnosis. So we reasoned that by putting our microscope on these tissues and just scanning the tissue, that we could look at all the areas of the esophagus and retain that spatial information. And if we saw a spot that looked suspicious, we could go back there and just continue look at that tissue and find exactly where the margins were and do the guided resections this way. And so we've been working with GI endoscopists. This has been in patients for colon cancer. We've been developing it in a handheld version for guided resection of brain tumors. And in the area of stem cell biology, we've really been looking at implantable microscopes. And we've made these microscopes, such as this one, to be MR compatible. This is a 1 Tesla permanent magnet MRI scanner for mice looking at our microscope in the abdominal cavity of a mouse. And the microscope is designed then to look with cellular resolution, in this case at tumors where the cells are undergoing an epithelial to mesenchymal transition that we heard about earlier today. So as these cells switch to a mesenchymal phenotype, they switch GFP on, and we can watch that change over time. So the idea is that we can begin to look at cell biology in living animals with reasonable resolution. So I'd like to finish with just 3 thoughts, and that is that imaging enables the in vivo study of cell biology, and when integrated with thorough studies in culture and ex vivo, can really reveal the nuances of cellular mechanisms and the subtlety of therapeutic responses. And in every case, we've set up a new model with imaging to look at something that we thought we understood. We always discover something new. And so going into an imaging study with your eyes wide open, you always see very interesting things. And it turns out that some of the science papers that we have came out of the fact that someone said, hey, that looks interesting. I don't know why that happened. I didn't expect it. And it was that unexpected result that led to interesting studies. So we have a unique opportunity with molecular imaging tools to ask and answer the hard questions about transplantation and regeneration, now in the context of the living organ systems. And advances in these tools will enable new insights and approaches in regenerative medicine. And even though I'm a fan of clinical translation, and many of our tools have been in the clinic, to get these tools, whether they're probes or hardware, into patients takes tremendous tremendous regulatory hurdles. So I would argue that visible animal models of human biology and disease comprise one of the most important contributions that molecular imaging will make to human health, because we can transfer tremendous amounts of knowledge from our now transparent animal models into the clinic. And these imaging tools serve to accelerate and refine the analysis of mammalian biology. And really, they offer a rapid readout for the development of new therapies. And I think we're beginning to appreciate that today, as you saw some of the other studies in chemical biology using imaging. With that, I'd like to thank the folks in my lab that contributed to these studies. We have tremendous group of collaborators, and some of the folks have left to start their own imaging programs at other institutions. And with that, I'll take any questions. Thank you. So the question was, how do you scan the mirror? And if you noticed, around those mirrors are these comb tooth actuators that are electrostatically activated. And by passing a current over those comb teeth, you can tilt the mirror X and Y. And so these two tethers that come out of the microscope, one's an electrical cable that allows us to scan the mirrors, and the other one is a set of optical fibers that carries light in and light out. And there's little cell phone connectors, it turns out, on the back to plug the animal in to take an image.
So what's the temporal resolution of that? Maybe another way, how long does it take to sample some cube of some size?
Yeah, that was a real concern of ours, because you can imagine if you're holding a microscope with 1 micron resolution at the end of a 1 meter long endoscope doing your endoscopy, the patient's moving, the endoscopist is moving. You're trying to hold this with 1 micron precision at the end of the endoscope. It's a real problem. If it takes you 10 seconds to image, you'll never collect any data. And so we've had to accelerate these. The first instruments we have are about, well, the first one was a tabletop system, and it was kind of slow. The next one was about the size of a laser pointer. That was a little bit quicker, but still we had some issues with motion artifact. The endoscopist could hold it on the tissue, and we could go over the surface of the tissue, but every once in a while, the patient or the endoscopist would jump, and you wouldn't be able to continue to mosaic those images into a larger field of view. And so those were slow. One nice thing about MEMS technology is that as you go smaller and smaller, it gets faster and faster. And so this needlepoint scan that we do, it takes milliseconds. And so it's not a problem with the needlepoint scan. Now, if you want to take an optical section, it takes still less than a second to get one section. But a cube is going to take us about 3 to 4 seconds. And so the idea was to have all three modes operational, the needle point, the plane, and the 3D reconstruction, so that you could look for the interesting pathology, do a section, and if necessary, hold the instrument still for a couple of seconds and get a cubic volume. So faster than it had been in the very beginning, but not quite fast enough to do cubic volumes, and also everywhere you want to do it. Also, mosaicing cubic volumes is a challenge. So you get one cube here, whereas if you have a plane, we can mosaic those images, and we can create very large fields of view and kind of use like a Google Earth approach to zoom in on cells and then back out to the entire organ and then to the entire section and then back into cells. So it depends on which mode That is one of the biggest problems, and we've tried to make the scan as quickly as possible.
I have one other question. Have you tried inserting this microscope vascularly to look at plaques, for example, atherosclerotic plaques, the biology of those?
I just got a text a few moments ago that that they started this study with rabbit aortas with some of Willem Mulder's particles. And he sent us some rabbit aortas, and they're being scanned today. There might be some applications there. The problem is when you miniaturize an instrument, you reduce the sensitivity. Even though by doing this dual axis, we get a higher dynamic range, the low NA optics are fairly inefficient at light collection. And so it's a trade-off. And so we were waiting for someone like Willem, who had really bright fluorescent dyes with these nanoparticles before we got into that area, because the sensitivity may not have been as good with some of the other just small molecule fluorescent dyes.
Thank you.